Three-Star Grunt by Sergeant Bob Bowen from The Leatherneck, April 1967. Read by Colonel Timothy Mundy, U.S. Marine Corps, retired. Lieutenant General Lewis William Walt leaned forward in his leather swivel chair. Lines furrowed his forehead. He spoke slowly. I can only say that if I didn't believe in what we're doing here with all my heart, I wouldn't be able to live with the lives that have been taken and the effort that has been expended. As commanding general of the 3rd Marine Amphibious Force and senior advisor to I Corps, the 5 northern provinces in South Vietnam, Walt had seen a lot of lives taken and a lot of effort expended since arriving in that country in June 1965. He had also seen a lot of progress. He cautions about thinking the war will end tomorrow, or the next day, but there's no doubt in his mind that it will end, and that the world will be better because it has been fought. It doesn't take a Marine long to find out what we're doing here, he said. The contrast of communist rule with democracy is very clear to him, and I think he feels, as I do, that if we don't stop communist aggression here and now, our next generation is going to be fighting a much tougher enemy much closer to home. More than his belief in the war itself, however, is his belief in his men, the men fighting the war. To the officers, he's a general's general. To the enlisted Marines, he's a three-star grunt. 3 years ago, only a handful of Marines could have told you who Walt was. Stars fell on him like they fell on Alabama, but the 7 rows of ribbons he wears on his dress uniform stand as mute testimony to an outstanding career. 2 Navy Cross medals, 1 Silver Star, 1 Bronze Star with Combat V, the Legion of Merit with Combat V, and a Purple Heart record his service since his commissioning as a second lieutenant on July 6, 1936. Walt snapped to his first attention at the age of 16 when he was signed up with the Colorado National Guard. He went through the ranks from private to first sergeant. At Colorado State University, he majored in chemistry and graduated as an honor student in his department with a Bachelor of Science degree. He was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army Field Artillery Reserve upon graduation, but resigned that commission to accept an appointment in the Marine Corps. He had never heard of the Corps before being offered that commission, and a military career was the farthest thing from his mind. His career plans lay in the field of chemistry. World War II changed all that. By the time the Japanese surrendered in 1945, Walt was a lieutenant colonel with enough ribbons above his left breast pocket to stock an exchange. He received his first star in July 1961. The second followed in May 1965, and less than a year later, Walt was promoted to lieutenant general. Walt's link with the enlisted men in his command defies the quote, if the old man wants it done, I guess I'd better get it done, end quote, type of military thinking. Today's Marine in Vietnam looks at Walt as a father, and the yes, sir reply to an order comes out of respect and not because it's the required answer. Lieutenant General Victor H. Krulak, commanding general of the Fleet Marine Force Pacific, Walt's immediate superior, brought this out. Marines have a tendency to inbreed, to act like a family, whether it's a platoon or a division. Walt emphasizes the family idea. Walt has a tremendous faith in the grunt, and the grunt knows it. I think the individual Marine, the man who carries the rifle, throws a grenade, and uses a bayonet, is the most important man in the Marine Corps, he says. He's the man who determines how well his unit attacks or defends on any battlefield. I'm sure that every officer feels very deeply about his men, he continued. I know that when I ask a man to go into combat, he is depending on me to give him all the support I can bring to bear to enable him to come out of that fight alive and unwounded and still accomplish the mission. If I'm a fighter down there in the rear ranks, if I'm a private or a corporal, I've got to know that I'm getting the support needed. This is morale. This is esprit de corps. This is confidence. What I'm really talking about here is teamwork, the essence of which is our air ground team in Vietnam. It is the responsibility of the commanding general to have this teamwork developed and executed every hour of the day and night. I have never witnessed closer teamwork than we have here in Vietnam, and I have never witnessed a more proficient and effective performance of duty in all ranks in both air and ground units than we have here in 3MAF. More than the teamwork within 3MAF is the joint effort of Marines, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Vietnamese fighting forces. Walt lauds this effort, for while the war is individualistic in nature, it's a culmination of individual effort that's getting the job done. It's a dirty war in Vietnam. When the dust isn't biting into your nostrils, the mud is sucking at your boots. When the sun isn't cooking your head inside your steel helmet, the rain is turning you into something akin to a piece of soggy bread. And the guerrilla, he never lets up. In a situation like this, morale of the troops is of prime consideration. Seldom does a week go by that Walt isn't out in the field with his Marines, shaking hands, advising, cautioning, listening, asking, answering, and thanking. "Are you getting enough food?" he asks one. "Yes, sir. I'm not gaining any weight, but I'm not losing any either." He spots a Marine preparing a foxhole. "Are you going to reinforce the top?" "Yes, sir." "That's good," Walt says. "They're probably going to hit you one of these nights, and the right planning now will save a lot of lives." A radio man gets the next question. "How are your batteries holding up?" "Fine, General. I've got enough for 2 more days, and we've got some more on order." "What are you doing, Marine?" he asks a man neck deep in a mud hole. "Digging a crapper, sir." More questions, more answers. He tells them they're all doing a fine job, and before leaving, he turns to a lieutenant colonel in charge and says, "I'd change jobs with you any day." The officer opens his mouth as if to say, "It's a deal," but instead he replies, "We need you where you are, sir." Walt smiles and climbs into his helicopter. "This is the Marine Corps," he says to a distinguished guest making the tour with him. "This is where the war is being fought." Walt would much rather make his command decisions from a foxhole on the front lines than from his office in Da Nang, but the dictates of war prevent this. His area of responsibility encompasses some 2.5 million Vietnamese civilians, and he has operational control of over nearly 3,000 square miles of terrain. Just visiting the scattering of command posts is a job in itself, a job Walt accomplishes as often as possible. In this venture, he averages around 100,000 air miles traveled each year. On one such helicopter flight, a Viet Cong sniper sent a round through the nose of the general's UH-1E, Huey. Both he and the pilot escaped serious injury. Walt was hit by fragments, and the aircraft was able to continue to its destination. Perhaps, however, the closest Walt has come to becoming a statistic in Vietnam's minus column was during the political upheaval in Da Nang last year. The only bridge linking downtown Da Nang with the Marines' Marble Mountain airfield had been captured, and no traffic was being allowed to pass. The bridge had been mined, and the Marines were told that any attempts to cross it would result in it being blown up. Walt needed that bridge. Backed up by a team of engineers, he walked to the bridge. When he reached it, he told the engineers to disconnect the explosives. He didn't stop. He continued walking toward the center where an enemy lieutenant stood. The lieutenant asked Walt to go back. Walt said he was going to walk it by himself or fight his way across with a company of Marines. "All right, General," the lieutenant said, "we die together." With that, he brought his arm down as a signal to detonate the explosives. Fortunately, the Marine engineers had disconnected them in time, but Walt had no way of knowing this. He had placed his life in the hands of his men. At command briefings concerning the activities of I Corps, Walt listens carefully. He understands, perhaps better than most, the implications of a sudden increase in Viet Cong activity in one area. He has been attending these briefings for the past 22 months, and the mind of a chemist he once was analyzes the situation quickly and responds with the decision of the general he is today. He chews out Marines when he sees something he doesn't like, and he commends that which he does like. The most difficult decisions, he says, are those having to do with the lives of my men. When I commit them to combat, I know that some of them are going to be killed or wounded. A commanding general must look at all facets having to do with the operation. He must evaluate and decide which course of action will be the most effective. He must consider carefully the risks he is taking as far as his men are concerned and determine his every means of support in that action. The decision is, do I commit them or do I not? Do I take some other means of accomplishing the objective? This careful weighing of the alternatives accounted for 11,500 Viet Cong dead during Walt's first 16 months on the job. But dead VC alone do not tell the story of the war. Civic action programs are doing a wealth of good in bringing the war to an end. More than 1 million civilians have received medical attention. Another 39,000 have received dental care. More than 2 million pounds of food has been distributed, along with 220,000 pounds of clothing. Schools, office buildings, wells, bridges, and homes have been built. School supplies and trade goods have been handed out. Working hand in hand with CARE, Marines have distributed more than $67,000 worth of useful items aimed at increasing educational standards, job skills, and in general, a way of life that, in some areas, has remained stagnant for thousands of years. For the most part, Walt is responsible for the birth of civic action as well as its success. He is behind it 100%, but he knows that it alone will not win the war. You have to compare the effectiveness of civic action and the military, he says. You can't have civic action without military protection. Yet certainly without both, you can't win the war. One is just as vital as the other. Walt believes that the guerrilla, the farmer by day and the Viet Cong by night, is the biggest detriment to a speedy conclusion of the war. If we don't win this battle with the guerrilla, this could go on for years, he says. He's a damned hard man to replace as compared with the North Vietnamese army. The guerrilla has a stranglehold on the people. They collect the taxes for the VC. They collect rice for the main forces and the NVA, recruit for the main forces and the NVA, furnish intelligence to the main forces and the NVA, and provide them with working parties. They are also extremely difficult to corner. First, we must find him, then identify him, and then drag him out of his hole. Winning the support of the civilian population is mandatory in routing out the VC element in the villages and hamlets. One giant step forward in that direction was taken with the birth of civic action. The next step, equally as important, was the creation of combined action companies throughout I Corps. These companies incorporate small units of Marines and Vietnamese Popular Forces personnel. They eat, sleep, and fight together. And the man in charge is the Marine enlisted man, still another example of Walt's faith in the individual Marine. Working side by side with the people of the villages they live in, these combined action companies, or CAC for short, are proving more valuable as time goes by. They help protect the village's rice, prevent taxation by the local VC, and in turn, information on Viet Cong activity in the area is beginning to filter in. In time, the Marines will leave the Popular Forces units and return to their parent organizations. Their mission will have been accomplished. That is, they will have instilled a confidence in the Vietnamese civilian soldiers and will have trained them to such a degree that they could fight alongside anyone in the country. Yet, another part of winning the war is the rehabilitation program for the VC defectors. In I Corps, some of these ralliers are being used as scouts, Kit Carson scouts, as Walt calls them affectionately. This program was initiated by Major General Herman Nickerson, commanding General 1st Marine Division. Knowing the country as they do, they are able to caution against possible minefields and booby traps, as well as identify areas used frequently by the enemy. It's a big undertaking that the United States has set about to accomplish in Vietnam, but slowly, day by day, the effort is beginning to pay off. By fighting here now, Walt says, we're freeing an oppressed people, a country that 10 or 15 years from now, because of its great potential and natural resources, and the people themselves, is going to be the cornerstone of the free world in Southeast Asia. Many men have died, and many more lives will be taken before that cornerstone is set firmly in place. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Lewis William Walt will continue to make the decisions, and he will continue to weigh each one carefully. Paramount in his mind will be the safety of his men in the field, his grunts, and his men in the air. He'll wonder how many lives will be lost on the next operation, and he'll think about those lives that have already been lost. They didn't die in vain, he'll say. They died for the cause of freedom, just like men died in World War II. That's Walt, a compassionate man, a man sensitive to the needs of his men, a man who has been described as one of the best tacticians who ever wore a uniform, a man who, despite a college degree and a knack for holding conversations with senators and other dignitaries, will always be remembered as a 3-star grunt to the men who served under him in Vietnam.